And one of the things that I like about that is that it keeps me thinking pretty hard sometimes about the effort that it takes to reconsider something you thought you knew. And I know I've been kind of harping on this, but I think it's a huge challenge. And I think it's a huge challenge in the context of a community like this. I mean, this room is full of people who more or less have some comprehension of the idea of church, right? I mean, you showed up for this, and it's a church. So most of us have some idea. Some of us have lots of ideas. Some of us, I was in church prenatally, and there are people that are here in that situation this morning. You know, there are kids in this building this morning who will say, I never didn't go to church. That some of us are that steeped in it, and those ideas are that deep and that established. And when we want to reconsider them, that can be really challenging, really hard work. Not unhappy work necessarily, but it can be challenging. And the same thing's true, I think, generally in lots of realms, right? It's true in relationships. I don't know if you've ever had the experience of having to reconsider what you thought was going on in a relationship, especially the kind of situation where you thought you knew what somebody was thinking or what they thought about you, and you had an experience with them that made it clear that your understanding of that was just way, way off. And this is the classic stuff that movies are made of, right? Oh, I thought you hated me. You love me? Oh, good, because I loved you all the way along, and now it's happy ending time, right? So it's easier to kind of dismiss this as a trite idea or a truism. But when we actually kind of auger into it a little bit, I think it's actually got some substance. Try to remember a moment like that in your own life. I'm not going to ask anybody to say anything about this, so you can remember any moment you want, and without fear. And then, if you can think of a moment like that, where you kind of had to reevaluate what you thought was going on in a relationship, think about, and this might be a little harder to remember, because most of us file this stuff deeper back, but try to remember how that revelation about the relationship not being the way you thought it was changed your actions, changed the way you behaved. The sensation of being deeply disliked or rejected, that's a sensation that really stings. It doesn't tend to bring out the best in most of us. But the alternative, the sensation of being received, of being cared for, welcomed and loved, that is a situation, those are the kind of sensations that we tend to respond to with our best. They pull good stuff out of us. And I don't think that's just true in human relationships. I think it tends to be true of the way that we think and act in our relationships with other beings, including deities. And how we think God feels about us, that's an interesting sentence, I realize, if you're in the think-feel dichotomy, but how we think God feels about us can have quite an impact on how we tend to act toward God or even toward ideas about God. I was having this conversation with a good friend of mine whose son recently got married to a woman that is adamantly anti-religious. And we could probably sum up this woman's belief about God by saying that she doesn't believe there is such a being, or if there is such a being, he's so messed up that humans shouldn't have anything to do with him. The line from a song that comes to mind is from Josh Ritter's song, where he says, some say that God is a drunkard for pain. That's a fabulous picture of that idea about God. So my friend's a pretty thoughtful and compassionate guy, and he said to me in describing the situation, he said, you know, I don't think that the God my daughter-in-law hates so much does exist. Or to put it another way, he was trying to say that any being that has the characteristics that this person assigns to God is not someone that anyone should interact with. This would be someone to be avoided at all costs, if they exist at all. So from one vantage point, we could say she's right. She's right. If that's the kind of being that God is, let's either just avoid that being utterly or reject what that being stands for and represents in the world and not have any part of it. If we polled people in North America, and it's been done, we have the polls about whether or not they believe in God, the significant majority would still say yes. And I add the qualifier still, because I would contend, and I think it could be easily defended, that we live in a post-Christian West. But this is not a survey about whether they're Christian or not. This is a survey about whether they believe in the existence of God or not. The vast majority would still say yes. That said, most of those polls don't gather anything further about that, and so it's hard to say what people might mean by that. And so in a North American context, this is kind of interesting because it could mean a lot of different things, right? It could be pretty much a reflex. I'm from the Western world, and our history includes this belief, and yes, I believe there's a God. It could mean that I'm superstitious. It could mean that what I'm really trying to do is cover my butt because maybe my grandma was right and there is somebody out there and maybe they're pissed, and so it might just be best if I said yes. You know, I get it. You're out there. Maybe it's that. Maybe it's just a relatively unconsidered intellectual assent to the unlikely possibility that the intricacy that we live in and are is a cosmic accident. Maybe something like that. Could be lots of different things. But if I took that list of examples, there's nothing in that list that would necessarily compel any of the people who said, I believe God exists, to actually consider the nature of the God that they say they believe in, or to muse over what the implications of that nature might be, or what kind of demands that might make on their life, on my life. Just none of those things would drive us sufficiently necessarily to that kind of a deliberation. It might, but not necessarily. If you guys weren't able to be here in the summer, and I realize Wednesday nights aren't magical and suddenly available, that's all fine and good. But if you've not been able to be here, the stuff that I've been poking around in has been in and around the parables of Jesus. And in really short version, the parables are stories where Jesus sets one idea against another in ways that really just kind of make you go home. They really make you kind of go, what? Really? And think really hard. One of the parables that we sort of opened but we didn't finish exploring was a parable that's often called the parable of the unforgiving or the unmerciful servant. And in particular, the framing of that parable in Matthew 18. And it's an important story in terms of Christianity's sacred text from a lot of different vantage points. And not the least of those is that it's one of those stories that prompts a consideration of how God deals with what might be considered the failings of these humans in the story. And I'm not going to ask for any kind of an answer, but I want us to just hit the pause button for a second and ask ourselves personally the question. So to be honest in our own recollection, how's summer been in this regard? In this regard, I mean human failings. Anything good that any of us aimed at and didn't hit? Anything destructive that we found ourselves aiming at and hitting right on the nose, maybe more than once? The point of the questions is not to sow some kind of seed of guilt so I can roll out a stock religious answer about whatever's plaguing our consciences this morning. That's not why I would ask that. The point is that no matter how we might measure such a thing, most of us would say, I have some failings as a human. And if we've given any thought to the character and nature of God, and if that consideration has brought us anywhere near the idea that God is a personal being, not an inchoate, distant, removed being, then we probably have also touched on the question of how God might feel about or interact with us as humans with failings. There's kind of a logical unfolding there, I think. That said, there are probably a good proportion of us in this room that have never felt the need to muse about that question, because we've been told exactly how God feels about human failings, and exactly what the roadmap is to keeping his burning wrath from landing all over our sorry selves. So we don't really deliberate much. We kind of think that's settled. And some of that roadmap, it may well be suggested, could be traced back to this particular parable we're going to dig into in a moment. So I think that's worth keeping in mind. But what if? What if the God that we may have been told is just barely restrained from thumping all of us unworthy sinners? What if a God that we can all imagine life being easier and better without isn't to be found in this story? At least not with a predisposition to that being the big storyline as a starting point. But what if? How would that impact the way that we feel about God? How would that impact the way that we feel about our failings? How would that impact the way we feel about others' failings toward us? Because we just might have a list of those too. So this parable is an interesting parable. Again, if you didn't happen to be here or hear the podcast on the week that we looked at the run-up to this parable, it was a while ago. You may not recall, but Jesus, as he heads into this parable, has just pretty much deked his disciples out of their skates on the question of how forgiveness works. He's pretty much just taken them completely by surprise. He's been trying, in his conversation with this group of people around him, to help people who say they're looking to him as a guru, they're looking to him as a spiritual leader, as somebody who can show them a way to live life that is good and right and worthy. And Jesus, I think partly in response to that and partly in his own wrestling with understanding and accepting that place for himself in society, has been trying to show the disciples in particular just how ridiculously good God is. And he's been trying really, really hard. And so he has just finished telling them, as we come into this chunk of the story, he's just finished telling them the parable of the lost sheep, the point of which is that the good shepherd seeks lost sheep unconditionally, and that there's no found sheep versus lost sheep grouping happening in this narrative. And the disciples, like most humans, find the idea that God is unrelentingly good hard to process. And of course they do. All we have to do to empathize with the disciples' dilemma is back ourselves up into our community time. Anybody hear the dilemmas in our prayers? Anybody hear the just unrelenting, unresolved nature of saying, God, we believe you're good. How come that baby isn't going to make it? For instance, because that's the one that I can't shake out of my head right now, out of my heart. This, to say that the disciples are stuck here is not to suggest that this is a group of humans who are extraordinarily dull. It's, I think, just to acknowledge that this story is peopled with ordinary folks who are wrestling with the kind of dilemma that just won't settle down and go away. And yet, from the vantage point of what Jesus says over and over again, the idea that God is unrelentingly, unconditionally good won't go away either. So we're on the horns of the dilemma with the disciples, if you will. At the very least, we have company in this story. And Jesus, quite possibly in frustration, has had a go at irony in this text, in an attempt to break through the idea barrier. And so he has told, just before this parable, he's told a parable about someone that has wronged us and how we should go to them once to seek reconciliation and then go to them again if that doesn't work, and we should bring some witnesses, and then if that doesn't work, we should bring the whole mess in front of the community, and then he says we should treat them like Gentiles and tax collectors, which doesn't mean what we tend to think it means. All we have to do is look at how Jesus treated Gentiles and tax collectors to get our heads around a different idea there. But the parable sounds to the disciples like three strikes and you're out. Because they're humans. Except that they kind of really want the idea of unlimited forgiveness. But it doesn't sound very plausible. It certainly doesn't sound doable. And so this other idea that Jesus rolls out right after the idea of this shepherd who just keeps looking for lost sheep no matter how stupid they are, unlimited forgiveness. So he tells that story and they're like, no, you can't really mean that. So he says, okay, try this. One strike? Two strikes? Getting worse. Three strikes, you're out. How about that? And the disciples, you can hear them doing the mental math. I'm going to need more than three strikes. Right? Personally, I'm going to need more than three strikes. So how about seven strikes? Right? I mean, you could, it's just kind of right there in the story. How about more chances? Because, you know, unlimited chances, not sustainable. Three chances, not enough. What does the middle look like? How about seven? And Jesus just kind of gets right in their face and says, okay, now you're starting to understand the dilemma. How about 70 times seven? How about a number that heads us back to where I started in the first place, which is unlimited? How about that? And so that's where we are when we hit this parable. That's exactly what's been going on. And that's super important, because otherwise it's just dead easy to misread this parable. I'm going to just read it for us so that we can understand maybe a little better, empathize a little better with the temptation to a concrete, literal reading of this thing, even though it's a parable, which means if you read a concrete and literal, you're making a literary mistake, among other things. Never mind a kind of cosmic mistake. But all right, give the whole game away. We can all go now. That's all I really have to say. Here we go. Here's the parable. Therefore, the kingdom of heaven, therefore, of course, as anybody who grew up in church can probably tell you, is just a way of Jesus in the text saying, because of all that, this. Therefore, the kingdom of heaven is like a king who wanted to settle accounts with his servants. As he began the settlement, a man who owed him 10,000 bags of gold was brought to him, and since he was not able to pay, the master ordered that he and his wife and his children and all that he had be sold to repay the debt. At this, the servant fell on his knees before him. Be patient with me, he begged, and I will pay back everything. The servant's master took pity on him, canceled the debt, and let him go. But when that servant went out, he found one of his fellow servants who owed him 100 silver coins. He grabbed him and began to choke him. Pay back what you owe me, he demanded. He had to do something with all that adrenaline from the near miss, right? Anyways, the fellow servant fell to his knees and begged him, be patient with me and I will pay it back. But he refused. Instead, he went off and had the man thrown into prison until he could pay the debt. When the other servants saw what had happened, they were outraged and went and told their master everything that had happened. Then the master called the servant in. You wicked servant, he said. I canceled all that debt of yours because you begged me to. Shouldn't you have had mercy on your fellow servant just as I had on you? In anger, his master handed him over to the jailers to be tortured until he should pay back all he owed. This is how my heavenly Father will treat each of you unless you forgive your brother or sister from your heart. When I get to heaven, I'm going to sit down with Matthew and say, who told you to put that last sentence in there? Do you know how much trouble you've caused? Anyways, now we come to the hard part. And the hard part is where we started. The hard part is trying to suspend, just for a few moments, the inclination to just stop where we already are. And stopping where we already are for most of us is a reading of this parable that seems the most plausible to us. And we're gonna talk a little bit more about what that is both this week and next week, because it's so potent, it's so hard to stand back from. The common reading of this parable could be summed up as, forgive those that wrong you endlessly, or be prepared to be tortured endlessly by God because you didn't measure the standard. I know that's shorthand, but does that strike anyone as familiar? Okay. You don't have to put up your hand or acknowledge it. We just know. So three strikes and you're out with the disciples kind of comes to mind, right? The fact that humans would hear Jesus tell a story like that our sacred text would give us a story like that, and we'd go, oh, yeah, well, there's a certain plausibility to that. I can understand how that would work. God being who God is, me being who me is. What I can also empathize with, though, when I think about the disciples, is their realization that if that's the way God operates, we're screwed. Fortunately, I would say, as usual, this parable refuses to fall to that kind of a simplistic reading. Parables generally do refuse to fall to a simplistic reading. They're not meant to. That's why they're parables. We're going to dig into this more because there's a lot here to wrestle with, but I want us to consider just very briefly as we kind of wrap up getting going on this, the behavior of the king. The king, of course, in the parable is a surrogate for God. This is not mysterious, it's not an allegory, so I use the word surrogate by choice there. But at the beginning of the parable, I think it would be fair to say that our impression of the king's view of the world is primarily that of a keeper of accounts, of a bookkeeper, of a scorekeeper. He knows who owes him what, and it's Wednesday, which is audience of the indebted before the king day, and he's just reeling in a big one in terms of indebtedness. He's got this servant, obviously a trusted servant, which is an intriguing implication of the parable, because you don't lend millions of dollars to a minion. You know, you lend millions of dollars to someone you trust. And this servant owes him an enormous, staggering debt. In today's terms, maybe $10 million. The point of the number is simply that the debt is radically unpayable. Now, parables also invite us to use our imagination. In fact, I think our sacred text invites us to use our imagination. One of my literary mentors calls it holy horsing around. If we're not willing to play with the text, we're just going to miss an awful lot of what it could have to speak to us. So don't abandon ship just yet. Imagine who a bookkeeper type of character would have kind words for. If the vantage point of the character is that the world runs like a system of accounts, like a ledger, for whom would the keeper of such accounts have kind words? Well, for the honest, for the upright, for the solvent. But for anybody that's in real trouble, for anybody that's in the kind of trouble this servant has somehow managed to get himself into, and he has surpassed even our Canadian consumer behavior in terms of accumulated household debt by quite a stretch. He's just in it deep. For anybody that gets in that deep, for that kind of character, the power holder who views the world like an accountant, like a bookkeeper, for that kind of character, the keeper of accounts is going to have no concern except to get his money back in whatever way he can. You owe me, and I am not going to stop hounding you until you pay it all back. And not only you, but everyone that you love and everyone that you care about, and kind of a ripple going out from there. It's kind of God as a drug cartel bad guy, right? He's going to kidnap the debtor's wife and kids, except that in this story, the debtor doesn't turn out to be a love-driven lone wolf hero that rescues everybody at the end of the day. He's just going to get locked up with everybody else. But just before the burly guys grab him by the arms to take him away, he falls down on his knees and he pleads with the king. He says, if we kind of went to a literal reading of the word that he uses to ask for mercy, he says, be big-hearted with me. Be big-hearted with me and... this is a very important part of this parable. Be big-hearted with me, and I'll repay you everything. Now, the reason that that's an important part of this parable might not be the first reason that comes to mind, so just hold that thought, we're going to get to it. But somehow, when the debtor says, be big-hearted with me, I'll repay you everything, zappo, presto, the king turns from being loan shark Louie into being this big softy, right? And he just forgives the servant, then he tells the big guys to let him go free. That's why I made the remark I did about needing something to do with all that adrenaline. Whoosh, could hear that bullet going right past my ear. That was a near miss. Boy, can't believe that just happened. But really, what's up with the king? Because as a character in the story, at this point, we could understandably feel like it's a little hard to know what to expect from this king. Unless we remember what Jesus and the disciples have just been talking about, which is why I spent so much time there. Because it's that discussion that motivated Jesus to cook this parable up in the first place. The discussion was about forgiveness. It was about the unlimited nature of God's forgiveness. It was about the non-bookkeeping nature of God's forgiveness. We're going to explore this more next week, but the servant, bless his heart, as my grandmother would have said, is still laboring under the misapprehension that the king thinks about the world primarily like a bookkeeper. And one of the things that tells us about the servant, never mind what his behavior, subsequent behavior tells us about him, but one of the things that tells us about the servant is that he is still thinking like a bean counter. He's still thinking like a keeper of accounts. We do tend to anthropomorphize our deities, don't we? We tend to make God in our image. I mean, it's what we have to work with, generally speaking. Our imagination. So I guess it's no big surprise, given our natural inclination to tit-for-tat sort of behavior around questions of justice and forgiveness, that the servant would imagine that the king functions the same way. But the king doesn't function that way. It's intriguing that the servant is also under the misapprehension because that the king is forgiving him his debt because he has offered to repay it all. He can't begin to repay it. But he thinks that's why the king turned from loan shark to softy, because he said he'd pay it all back. Because that's the way bookkeeping spirituality works. That's the way making God happy when we think it's about keeping score works. Give me some mercy, and I'll still measure the standard. I'll pay it all back. He can't even imagine paying it all back. Do you think the king doesn't know that in this story? The king would have to be an idiot. He could be as math challenged as I am, which is considerable, and know in a moment that this debt was not repayable. The king, to put it another way, forgives the servant's debt for reasons that are entirely internal to the king. In other words, the king forgives the servant's debt just for the asking, because the king has it in him to do. It is the character of the king to do so. It's not good bookkeeping. It's not good business. It's not good math. It's disconcerting relationship. It throws everything to the wind. But it's what's in the king to do for reasons of his own. And so he does it because the debtor asked him to. All the debtor brings to this is the little death of acknowledgement of indebtedness. That's it. But the debtor doesn't feel that way. The debtor feels like he brought a lot more to the table. He brought the offer to pay it all back. You know what it would cost that debtor to acknowledge the problem? It would cost that debtor their ego. It would cost that debtor actually looking down the barrel of the gun of that debt and going, there is no hope of me ever paying that back. And when I ask for mercy, I'm actually not going to have to, I better not qualify the request, because I have nothing to qualify it with. I actually should just say, please. I can't do it. Which is a kind of death, isn't it? Which is a kind of choice to operate in a world in a way that isn't very plausible to us, in a way that we find difficult to operate, in a way that's hard to do. If we were to translate this into that relational illustration that we started with, what the servant missed here was the aha moment of realizing that the way he thought the king viewed him, as someone who owed him an unpayable debt and who would extract that payment by hook or by crook if it took forever, he misses the aha moment of realizing that that way of looking at the king was just completely and utterly wrong-headed. And he made the mistake that's so easy to make, which is to think that God is like us, that God operates the way we do, that he's a keeper of relational accounts that approaches life with a primarily mathematical understanding of justice, just barely mitigated by a grudging system of sacrifice. The point of the king's choice in this parable is that that is not the case. And that should probably make us go, peace.